This is Investigative Poetics, the true story of a daughter investigating her father's crimes. Join me, even Christine Gardner, as I examine the price of shame and the consequences of our lies. Because poetry is what survives. This is episode 2, Above the Fold, because the morning after my father died, his suicide was front page news. Not so long ago, and in another lifetime, the news was tangible, a physical artifact, something that dirtied your fingers with newsprint. It was definite, disposable, and concrete. An object of organization. A daily record. When I was growing up, my father read the morning paper as a ritual. I remember walking with him to the newspaper box at the intersection on Saturday mornings when I was a child. We would pass the white house with the white fence, and when we got to the corner, he would deposit a few quarters into the palm of my hand. I would feed the quarters into the slot and pull open the little door so my father could reach in, grab the paper, and scan the headlines. Back home, I examined the comics while Dad sat with a cup of coffee, spread the pages over the kitchen table, and read the paper deliberately and by sections. This is how he marked the beginning and the end of each day. The local paper was the closest thing he had to a religion. And the morning after my father died, his suicide was on the front page of the Philadelphia Inquirer. His face and name were displayed above the fold. I was living in Colorado, a doctoral candidate in an English department. Most of my waking hours were devoted to the practice of textual creation or the act of literary analysis, and I maintained a cold, critical distance from the story as it unfolded back home in Philadelphia, where the newspapers were delivered in plastic sleeves to people's doorsteps and stacked beside the cash registers at supermarkets and gas station convenience stores. The phone rang before dawn, and I sprang out of bed. "Oh my God, are you okay?" It was Abby, my closest childhood friend. Her voice was high and alarmed. "My dad went for coffee and saw the news. Why didn't you tell me?" In my mind's eye, I saw her father physically recoil from my father's face in the paper. I imagined the words drumming like artillery down the front page. "I'm fine," I heard myself say. The words sounded slow and detached, as though I were half asleep or underwater. "When are you coming home?" she asked. "Do you want me to meet you at the airport?" "I think I'm going to drive," I said. "What do you mean?" "Well, I'm going to be home for the whole summer," I said. "I'll need the car." The truth was that in the last conversation I would ever have, my father had told me it would be better to drive home. It was his final directive, and I wanted to honor his wishes, but that was too intimate and complex to articulate. Besides, the drive would give me something to do, and put space and time between my body and the finality of my father's act. "What about the funeral?" she asked. "Well, it's going to be at least a week until the funeral," I said, omitting the fact that the coroner had not yet released my father's body. "You can't drive alone," she said. "Do you want me to come and drive back with you?" So within an hour, Abby had booked a plane ticket, and it was decided. Her flight would get in the next day, and she would drive with me across 7 states and 1,700 miles. From Denver to Philadelphia. Then we hung up, and I silenced my phone. I opened my laptop, googled my father's name, and read the news. Philadelphia Academy founder, and apparent suicide. Charter school founder Brian N. Gardner, under federal investigation in connection with his management of the school, committed suicide yesterday, police said. Brian Gardner, the former darling of Philadelphia's charter school movement who fell from grace amidst financial scandal, shot himself to death yesterday in the parking lot of a regional rail station. Police confirmed that Gardner died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound shortly before 1:30 p.m. in the parking lot of the Bethares train station. The embattled Gardner, 63, was the subject of an active federal probe related to his management of the Philadelphia Academy Charter School, a Northeast Philly school he founded in 1999. It was a complex and shameful obituary, the culmination of a scandal that had played out on the front page for over a year. A series of investigative reports revealed how my father had built a network of charter schools, consulting companies, and shell nonprofits by which he had systematically stolen hundreds of thousands, probably millions of dollars, from the school district of Philadelphia. For years, he had siphoned funds earmarked for the education of children through a complex scheme of contracts, land deals, and inflated rents. The articles confirmed what I had always known in my heart, but had never been able to prove. My father was a fraud. Well, whatever he was also my father, and so I felt for him. Pitied him, really, when the news broke and he became the headline. Not because he was being unfairly persecuted or wrongly defamed. I mean, if anything, the articles treated him fairly, always referencing his decades of service and good reputation. But because he had few interests beyond networking and reading the paper. Now he was stripped of his title and could no longer work, and his disgrace was front page news. So there was no solace anywhere, least of all in the paper. In a way, it was poetic, the way justice always and never is. Quote, sources with knowledge of the investigation said that indictments were imminent. An internal report alleged that Brian Gardner and his associate Kevin O'Shea had systematically looted the school for personal gain. The report said that more than $700,000 was missing from a school account and cited substantial evidence of wrongdoing by Gardner, a former public school principal, and O'Shea, a former police officer. End quote. There were also words of care and condolence, like before founding the charter school, Gardner was a popular principal at a local elementary school in the Northeast, and he was so well regarded that staff members and many families followed him to the Philadelphia Academy. Members of the community expressed shock and sorrow over Gardner's death and recalled him as a trailblazer and a pioneer in the charter community. I was struck by this language, trailblazer, pioneer. They implied conquest. The words themselves part of a broader lexicon of colonialism and social control. The article went on to suggest that through his work, Gardner had contributed to the lives of countless children. But I wondered, what did he contribute? What was his legacy? This is a real tragedy, the article went on to say. I hope people can remember the great things he did. Of course I remember. He was my father. I remember everything. We are extending prayers to his family, the article concluded. There was such irony and magnanimity in the statement. I was his closest family, his eldest daughter, his favorite, and I felt certain I was not deserving of public prayer. At the end of the article, I made the mistake of scrolling through the comments. Amid words of disappointment and incredulity were other words like boom, good riddance, piece of trash. That's when I learned. Never read the comments. On Facebook, I received a message from a high school acquaintance asking if I imagined that before shooting himself, my father had thought about throwing himself onto the tracks in front of a passing train. No, I hadn't thought of that until now. Of course, I blocked him, but I couldn't block out the questions, couldn't stop thinking about the coroner, suicide, natural death, and death ruled as an accident. A few weeks before he pulled the trigger, my father nearly overdosed on insulin. He had been recently diagnosed with diabetes. He loved bagels, donuts, cookies, and ice cream and had always been heavy, but the stress of public scrutiny was too much for his system. In the wake of the media coverage and federal probe, he ate for comfort and because there was nothing else to do. Towards the end, his belly was as big as a bear's and his skin was thick and ash pink. One evening, he locked himself in the bathroom for almost an hour. When he came out, he was stumbling and slurring his speech. My stepmother, Darlene, called 911. Hospital blood tests confirmed extreme hypoglycemia, and the doctors concluded that Dad had accidentally mixed up his dosage. But I suspected the only accident was that he ended up in the hospital instead of the morgue. He was kept under observation for several days before coming home, sheepish and depressed, with drug facts printed out in big letters. After that, Darlene monitored his injections, and Dad withdrew further and further into himself. It was around the same time that my mother found the note. It had been 10 years since the divorce, but my mom had never moved on, and Dad still had a key to the house. One evening, she came home from work and found an envelope on the kitchen counter. It was a handwritten note about how sorry he was, how she deserved better, how proud he was of the children. I knew what it said because my mother called to read me the letter over the phone. She said, "How many spurned women ever receive this kind of vindication?" I said, "It's a death note, Mom." "Of course not," she said. "How could you say such a thing?" I couldn't choke out a response, so I swallowed the truth. What I'd been saying to anyone who would listen for over a year. He'll kill himself before he goes to prison. Since the news first broke, my family had spoken very little about what was going on in the press and the courts. We were a broken Irish Catholic family, and repression, guilt, and denial were all part of our heritage. We lived a code of silence, following a complex set of arcane and unspoken rules as my father simultaneously tried to maintain control of the narrative and put his affairs in order. Now he was dead, and the family was speaking not about what had happened, but about what would happen next. We were in constant contact, but the conversation amounted to a terse exchange of information about travel plans and funeral arrangements. My father's body, which had not yet been released, would be cremated. A funeral mass was arranged. We were all on autopilot, operating by instinct. I wrote short formal emails to notify my professors, my supervisor, and the department chair that my father was dead, that I was going to Philadelphia and would submit my end-of-term work remotely. I felt everything, anxious, vindicated, empty, and nothing. My friends took turns watching over me, traveled great distances to stay with me day and night, helping me clean, pack, and ready the apartment for sublet. They were sympathetic and wholly present. My friend Miriam sat beside me while I went through my closet and sorted my clothes. She held my hand and told me it was safe to cry, but my affect was glacial. I felt vast, cold, and sublime. I was very calm, but not entirely rational, and I insisted she take home armloads of clothes she would never wear, including a sea-green crushed velvet dress that I had worn to my junior prom. She cleaned the refrigerator. I scrubbed the tub. We emptied the dresser drawers and carried boxes to the storage closet in the laundry room. I kept checking the internet for news, I was grateful for the clear factual account of what had happened and noted small inaccuracies in the reporting, tiny tears in the narrative fabric of reality. It's interesting what the mind latches onto. A subsequent article stated Gardner's body was not far from his black Mercedes-Benz, but my stepsister Stephanie told me that Dad had driven the Volvo to the train station that day, and I believed her. To the end, he was still calculating costs, and he wouldn't have done anything to diminish the resale value of the Mercedes. The report concluded Gardner lived with his wife and children, including a 2-year-old son. And the statement was mostly true. He did live with his wife and her children, whom he had adopted, but the baby was a 15-month-old girl, my half-sister, Leah. The calls and messages kept coming. I spoke to my family and closest friends. The rest of the time, I answered the phone and refused to answer the phone as I liked. I didn't even tell my boyfriend, Burkhan, what had happened until he called to check in and started chatting casually about his laboratory experiments. "My dad died," I said bluntly.
"What do you mean?"
"He killed himself." There was an edge of cruelty in my voice. Part of me wanted to punish him for not knowing, for not calling until now, for living so far away, for not reading my mind. "Are you kidding me right now, CG?"
"No,"
I said. "He shot himself." "Oh my God," he said. "What can I do? What do you need me to do?" "That's my mom calling on the other line," I said. Another part of me wanted to protect him from what I knew and the darkness that consumed me. "I have to go now." It was easier to take the next action step than it was to slow down, to think, to see the big picture. So I kept my head down and I did what needed to be done. Made sure the bills were paid, scrubbed the kitchen sink, vacuumed assiduously, left a key and detailed notes for the subletter, filled the gas tank, checked the air pressure in the tires, drove to the airport to pick up Abby, and hit the road. Abby sat beside me in the passenger seat, adjusting the music as I navigated the plains of Kansas. I was in the throes of catastrophe, and I was so focused on where I was going and how I would get there that I couldn't see anything else. In Missouri, she reminded me that we needed to eat, so we stopped at an Arby's where I forced down some waffle fries and ginger ale. Then we were back on the road. Night fell. I remember an endless dark tunnel of highway over which my mind projected my father's last moments. I imagined him driving to the train station and parking close to the tracks. I could almost see his hand reach for the gun. I tried to summon the tears, but they just wouldn't come. At midnight, Abby insisted that we stop and sleep somewhere. We stayed in a motor hotel off the highway and left the next morning at dawn. I drank coffee and watched the miles tick away as I drew closer and closer to Philadelphia, the place I was from, the place I was ashamed to return. My anxiety mounted as the landmarks and signposts grew increasingly familiar, mile by mile, turn by turn. I drew closer and closer until I pulled into my mother's driveway and I was home, back at the scene of the crime. Those first days were a blur, and when I look back, the only scene in clear focus is the afternoon I went to pay my respects to my stepfamily, who lived across town in a Tudor-style house with 4 bedrooms and an in-law suite just over the Philadelphia line. My stepsister Stephanie met me at the door with tears in her eyes and the sweet, aging black lab pressed against my legs. The grandfather clock loomed in the foyer. Darlene and her sisters were gathered at the kitchen table. My stepbrother Nathaniel, who was 16, stared blankly into the computer screen. And Christian, who was 17, was anxiously pacing the yard. The baby was sleeping upstairs. Stephanie led me into the dining room where she had arranged photos of my father into a series of poster board collages. "He looks so happy," she said. My eyes glazed over as I looked at the pictures. Yes, in the photos, my father was smiling, but he didn't look happy to me. He looked red in the face, bloated, gloating, grimacing, self-important, self-sabotaging, big, small gangster, pretending. My father. The complexity of his face stunned me. In the kitchen, Darlene and I exchanged a brusque embrace. Her features were drawn tight with worry, but even in her grief, Darlene was an unusually beautiful woman. The diamond heart she wore on a white gold chain flashed at her throat. She offered me a cup of tea and turned to put a mug of water into the microwave. "Do you want milk in your tea?" she asked. "No, thank you," I said. And she handed me a pale yellow mug filled with weak tea. And we sat at the table like a bereaved family. "I just can't believe it," someone said. "He was under a lot of pressure," someone else said, "but I thought he was holding it together." "Did he leave a note?" I asked. "No," Steph said tearfully. "He didn't say goodbye." "He called me that morning," I said. "He told me he was going to the city to meet with his lawyer, but he must have been on his way to the train station." I didn't mention the note he left for my mother. To do so seemed inexplicably cruel. There was a long silence. "Where did he get a gun?" My voice, barely a whisper, cut through the room. Eventually, Darlene said, "He bought it last week." "There were receipts," Stephanie said. "He had bought it the day before he died." The tone in the room suggested that the time for questions was over, and it was best to move on. Upstairs, the baby started to cry, and Darlene disappeared into the foyer. The family sat quietly at the table, and I looked blankly around the room. My father's slippers were on the floor in the living room, next to his big leather chair, which was imprinted with the shape and weight of his body. There was his picture on the bookshelf by the hearth. My father was everywhere, but he wasn't there. Darlene reappeared holding the baby. Leah was red in the face and still whimpering. "She doesn't understand what's happening," Darlene said, stroking her hair. Everyone said the baby resembled my father, but I knew better. With her red blonde curls and blue eyes, Leah looked just like me. I excused myself to the bathroom. My hands were shaking so violently that I struggled to close the door behind me. I looked in the mirror. My eyes were bloodshot and my face was flushed. I opened my mouth to scream, but no sound came out, and my whole body was racked with something between terror and grief. But it was as if someone had cut out my voice. I kept trying to scream, but there was no release, just a high-pitched hiss of air. And then I was on my hands and knees, heaving, and there was drool coming out of my mouth, and it pooled on the floor. And I sobbed like that for a long time. Ugly, isolated, and inconsolable. Until the grief recoiled like a snake within me, and I was able to stand. I washed my face and inspected myself in the mirror and steadied my gaze until my eyes were as placid as a mask. Then I went back to the kitchen and sat with my stepfamily at the table. And for another half an hour, we made small talk, but no one mentioned the latest headline. "Despite suicide, case will continue." Though Brian Gardner ended his life on Wednesday afternoon, the investigation into his alleged financial looting of the Philadelphia Academy Charter School is still on track. "Basically, the investigation is continuing," Jack Downs, the school district's inspector general, said. "It's not done." So the worst had happened. But the story wasn't over. and in order to get through to the next moment, we all had to maintain appearances. Thank you for listening to Investigative Poetics, and please join me for episode 3, About an Educator, which contrasts my father's reputation as a community leader with the bold realities of his crimes. This episode references articles by Mensa Dean, Dan Hardy, and Martha Woodall, published in the Philadelphia Inquirer and the Philadelphia Daily News in May 2009. Investigative Poetics is a work of creative nonfiction. These stories depict actual events as truthfully as recollection permits and can be verified by research. These stories are true, but some events have been compressed, some dialogue has been recreated, and some names and identifying details have been changed to protect the privacy of the real people involved. Investigative Poetics is written by Evan Christine Gardner. The theme music is by Bobby McVitie, with sound production and engineering by Michael Lesko, graphics and art by Nicole Franco, web design by Marco Jovic, and photography by Jeannie Sai.